What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Grey Malkin Lane podcast, where queer friends and allies gather to review and discuss the original X-Men comics in continuity order. Now the theme on the show in March is going to be gimmicks. We're going to be talking about the worst and weirdest versions of the X-Men on the show. Last week, I got to delve into the world of power pachyderms, which is a world where all the X-Men are elephants. And today, we're going to be covering other various animal hybrids. I'm so happy to be joined by the incredible hosts of the X-Men podcast. Okay, EX-MEN, which is a brilliant name for two hilarious trans girls running this show. The only other show out there that has a name this clever is my gay friends in Washington, D.C., who have an X-Men show called Homo Superior, which is also an amazing name. I'm so happy to have Beth and Shawnee here on the show. If you guys have been following them on Instagram, they're posting these hilarious, wonderful video clips about all things X-Men. I can't wait to get to know you both. Thank you for coming on the show. Let me have you introduce yourselves with your names and pronouns. Tell us how you met and how you started your show. We're just going to kind of begin there.
Well, my name's Beth, she, her.
And I'm Shawnee, she, her.
In terms of how we met, Shawnee and I play in a band together called Beth Seymour and the Lizzies, because I'm so vain, I named the band after myself twice. But we connected before that, having played like in shows in like our older respective bands before kind of becoming friends and coming together. The show came about because I am about one of the biggest X-Men fans on the planet, and Shawnee had never read anything at all. And I told her I'd had this idea kicking around. I'm like, it was just kind of like an off the cuff joke. I'm like, you know, wouldn't it be funny if there was a trans girl hosted podcast called X-Men, get it? Because, you know, technically speaking, I guess we used to be men. And she's
you were
like,
women the whole time, but by societal standards, yes, I love the pun.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. That's it. She goes, that's not a joke anymore. We're doing that. So it's kind of
all I needed to hear, and it was a massive yes.
It's fun, this dynamic we have. We started from the beginning of, well, we started from Giant Size X-Men so we could get into Claremont's run, because that's where the good stuff starts.
And my show started with the 60s stuff, and it took us like 3 years to get to Claremont, so I understand.
My condolences. Shawnee, is there anything you want to add?
I think you summarized it well. I was a really big fan of the X-Men from like the cartoon and the movies. So like as an idea, I always really loved them and gravitated towards them, but I never really got into comics. So this is my perfect entry point because Beth knows everything there is and I know nothing.
That's such a fun premise. Okay, so my really dear friends Justin and Alicia have the X-Wife podcast. And their initial premise was Justin loves the comics and Alicia had never read them. But their tagline on the show constantly is, it's X-Wife, like X-Men, not like former wife. We're still married, everyone.
the second you said that, I'm like, oh my God, if they got divorced in the midst of the podcast?
That would be dramatic. Exactly. Well, then we would go the Jay and Miles route, right? Everybody knows their story as well, for those of you that follow Jay and Miles. There's a cute little subgenre of X-Men queer podcasts out there. How has it been launching into fun X-Men commentary?
I have been stoked with the response, honestly. Because looking through our comment sections and everything on TikTok and Reels and what have you, it doesn't seem like there's any straight X-Men fans. So it just, everybody in our comment section has been like very positive in engaging with us. And we haven't had, like, I've been on the internet a long time. You know, there's always people who want to tell you you're wrong. And we get it every now and then. But mostly people are just stoked that we're doing what we're doing and engaging with us. And we have a very idiosyncratic brand of humor, I guess, the people who have listened to the show have just sort of taken to.
You guys just make each other giggle. It makes me smile so big. thing. I love things that make me feel happy, especially in fascism America 2026, which is a terrible place. But things that make me smile and bring joy are such a huge thing. Let's talk about your music for just a minute. Shawnee, how would you describe Beth's music style?
It's punk as hell. But in a way that will make you cry, both because of the devastatingly poignant lyrical content, but also it just gets you right in the heart. If you are queer or trans or have just gone through like any sort of struggle in life, she just has such a way of articulating it to make you feel less alone in a really powerful triumph.
So Beth, singer, songwriter, guitar player.
Yeah.
And how would you describe Shawnee's music style?
Shawnee is one of the most phenomenal musicians I have ever had the honor of playing with, because we started this band early last year and I set the songs through, and I've never had it before that somebody turned up for a first jam with me and she already knew every part and also the backing vocals. And she just is like a very instinctive player, somebody who like the right thing to do just comes to her. And I just think we have this great energy together where, you know, I always look over at her while we're rehearsing or playing a gig or whatever. And, you know, we just smile at each other and we're like, we're locked in. We're in the zone.
And Shawnee, are you also a singer?
Yes, I am. Sorry, we're getting tears on the pod, the earliest that we've ever done it.
Crying's allowed on the pod. We always say that.
Crying's allowed on our pod. So I assume the same here. Yes, I do a bit of singing. Yeah, I am mainly into backups at the moment because Beth is an absolute powerhouse and it's just a joy to be singing along with her.
I love a punk queer band. I can't wait to hear some of your stuff. You have to send me links later. I have an amateur band here as well. I'm a singer. My husband's a piano player, but my husband also plays keyboards sometimes for a local band of rock and roll drag queens, which is very fun. Oh. I love that scene every time. We're in Salt Lake City, which is a crazy place. There's a wide queer scene here, which is not what you would expect always. And then Beth, can I hear a little about your origins with the X-Men? For many queer readers, the X-Men represent a safety and a sense of being seen.
I first connected with the X-Men when I was about 6 years old, you know, and like for a lot of people my age, it would have been through the animated series.
And just for context, Beth is approximately 17 now. I'm just letting it
I'm 35.
Oh my God, you look amazing.
Oh, thank you. The people on the audio format aren't going to hear that, but you know, they can scroll my Instagram. Hype me up, gang. It was just this franchise I always connected with. And for the longest time, I guess I just couldn't work out why. You know, I was thinking to myself, we've talked about this on our pod before, like, I don't think I'm a minority, but why do I resonate with this so deeply? But these comics have, it's been like a constant in my life, and I've had a bit of a tumultuous existence, and I've been through a lot. And these comics always lend me a safe place to escape to. So on the journey of like discovering myself and becoming the person I am, you know, it's going to always resonate with a queer person that the X-Men are all different and they come together and they united through their differences. And it's this sense of found family and connection translates very easily across. So it's very obvious to see why this franchise would connect with people so deeply. But I've been probably reading and collecting X-Men for, it's got to be close to 30 years now. Like I said, it's just always been there for me.
Yeah, I've shared this on the show a few times, but I grew up in a very abusive household as a queer kid, and X-Men was like my refuge, particularly in high school when things were pretty bad. And I by the time I graduated college, I had thousands of books, and I ended up writing the Marvel handbooks for years as like part of a team. This like encyclopedic knowledge of X-Men was like such a huge part of my 20s, and now in my 40s, I'm going back and like doing the show, and it just feels like revisiting my childhood all over again. It's a very special thing. Beth, who are your characters, your X-Men characters?
Emma Frost, she is an absolute massive one for me, and a style icon, obviously.
So Spiral and Emma, that's a very particular vibe.
Emma is, she resonates with me in that she's this person who has this reputation for being bad, but she's always actually trying to do the right thing. She's just very blunt and standoffish about it. And sometimes you got to do the wrong thing to do the right thing, I suppose. Also, she's hot as hell. And growing up, I always absolutely adored Rogue. You know, I've always had this, you know, I'm trans. Like, I've had this funny stuff around, you know, my body and around, you know, physical contact. So this character who couldn't touch anybody, that obviously connected with me, even if I didn't really understand why. And Rogue is the character that, as changes have kind of come to her over the years, those changes have stuck when they don't always for a lot of other characters. So that's, I think that's something.
It's been a wild thing through my show to befriend a lot of comic book professionals. Lenore Zann, who does the voice of Rogue, is a friend now who I adore. She's a huge trans advocate, and she very much knows the you can't touch me or I'll take your life force energy and how that resonates with the queer community. And if you've read the recent Emma Frost limited series from just this like last few months, have you read that 5-issue limited?
You know what? I just grabbed the last issue the other day and I haven't cracked into it yet.
Well, I'm gonna give you some insight before you pick it up. So I have not had the writer on the show, but I did get to talk to her, Amy, in New York last year for a long time about the series. And she wrote Emma as a trans woman. Now it's not canon, but the way she approaches Emma in the series is from a trans female perspective, which is going to make it really special for you as you go. It's good.
That's been a fan canon for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Too. And there's like, even there were some implications in some of Morrison's notes, I think from the Morrison era when they were working on new X-Men that, you know, like the idea ended up on the cutting room floor, but it, you know, there was something there.
There's vibes.
Yeah, there's always been vibes. You know, she's a character who's made herself into the most perfect version of herself based on, like, if you read that old Emma Frost ongoing from, like, when's that, 2003-ish? Like, she just looks like this completely different character, and it's not a good series. I'm not going to go on to defend that series. But you're about to tell me, oh, I'm friends with that writer, too. I don't remember who wrote
it. I am. Carl Ballers. It's a black man writing a white woman. And this is funny. You could go back and listen to my interview with Carl Ballers about this. So he was given the instruction by Marvel to write it as like an all ages family friendly book, which he had to do. And they wouldn't like let him use the Hellfire Club because they felt like that was too dark. But then they slapped all these like pornographic covers on the front of the book.
Those covers are insane.
They're so crazy. It's a crazy interview. Go back and listen to my interview with
him. I have to listen to that now. Look, it's been a while since I read it, but the craziest thing about it is that all those like bonkers saucy covers, like the ones where she's like Emma Frost, are on the issues where she's like a teenager and she's got like her dark hair and her school uniform and stuff. And then it gets to the second half of the series and it swaps over and she's dyed her hair blonde in the second half of the series. And all of a sudden we're back at schoolgirl Emma on those covers.
Yeah.
And I can't work it out.
Right hand was not talking to the left hand per se. Now, Shawnee, you're approximately 19 from the way I can judge things, but tell everybody about your intro to the series. Did you connect to any particular characters when you were originally watching the shows or the movies? And what's it been like for you to jump into the Claremont world from a 2026 perspective?
Yes. Well, you know, as a 19-year-old, like we had to get past the age gap and stuff, but no, I am 35 as well. But yes, like I think me and Beth started in a similar place in that the original 90s cartoon was absolutely my entry point. And same sort of thing, like I just had this feeling when I watched it that really changed my brain chemistry. Just this bunch of misfits who were criticized from the outside world but banding together into this found family just resonated with me in a really profound way that I just couldn't put my finger on for a really long time. But yeah, from that original show, like Gambit was my boy, of course. Like, he's cool as hell. He throws exploding cards. He's got a cool trench coat. Just like, I loved everything about him.
We love a fashion moment for sure.
I've always loved a fashion moment. That's why Jubilee was my other one from there. Like, yeah. Absolute queen. Storm has always been there as well as just this literal force of nature who I have always loved. So I was overjoyed going into the Claremont era that at least one of those characters was here with Storm's introduction. And I was telling Beth, I was trying to manage my expectations because I know that like writing in the 70s, particularly comic writing, I had this sort of idea of what it was. And I'm like, okay, I'm not going to go into this expecting Shakespeare. Little did I know that
literal Shakespeare.
Maybe main influences Shakespeare and literally quotes Shakespeare in like the second issue that we read. So that has been like such a joy that there are so many beautifully written character moments and prose in these comics that I had no idea that I was in for. And I've just fallen in love.
It's so much fun. I'm spending a lot of time in the early 70s on my show right now. And I take a very academic lens. And in these early 70s in America, right when Chris Claremont was taking over the books, there were all these kind of social issues shifting here. So the idea of like Russia and the Cold War and where Colossus fits into that, the idea of queer rights and civil rights and watching the advent of characters like Luke Cage and the Falcon and everybody popping up, female-led solo titles happening at this time because of second wave feminism like Spider-Woman and Ms. Marvel. And then you watch like what happens with Storm and Jean Grey when Claremont gets his hands on powerful women. Horror tropes were relaxed. So like before a certain point, you couldn't say the word zombie in a comic, but now, you know, the X-Men are fighting like Kirok the Damned. And like, it's like the soundtrack that I've heard you guys talking about, right?
Oh, that's our boy, Kirok the Shatterer of Souls.
Favorite issue.
So yeah, it's really fun to put all of this into context. Now, I'm going to take you guys all over the pop culture world as we are reviewing different genres of the X-Men. I'm going to presume none of you or neither of you had seen any of these iterations of the X-Men before. These are crazy, crazy journeys. Beth, would you rather live in the world of the X-Bugs, the Marvel Apes, or the Alligator Lokis?
Oh, honest to God, I love that Marvel Apes series. Like, that's where I want to be.
And Shawnee, same question. Where would you live?
Oh, I mean, if I lived in Alligator Loki world, would I get to be one of those cute alligators?
Because absolutely.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's going to have to be Alligator World for me.
See, you got to pick the cute one. I got to pick the one where there's all the drama and action because I want the tea. I want the gossip.
And I'm going to go live in the world of the Uncanny X-Bugs, which I find delightfully stupid. Okay, so Marvel, we're not going to do a ton of setup here, but Marvel in the mid-80s is really capturing a ton of Saturday morning cartoon energy. Go look at any American cartoon from like 1985 through 1992, and you're going to find cute, bordering on gross. So you jump from like the world of like the Smurfs and the Gummy Bears, and by the time you get into the early 90s, we're more like Ren and Stimpy and Beavis and Butthead, and it's all like boobs and butts and farts and like really stupid humor. Things really shifted. The Simpsons start right in the middle of all of this. So like animation is going through a big revolution, and Marvel has a huge line of parody comics. One of the most famous, which we've seen visited in the Spider-Man movies and even in recent series, is the character Peter Porker, the Spectacular Spider-Ham, where he lives in a world of all cartoon animals and every character is a parody of something else. Sometimes really uncomfortable, like the Red Skull is the Red Gull and Captain America is Captain America-Cat, right? Like there's all these little funny versions of this. Now, in the end of Peter Parker, the Spectacular Spider-Ham number 2, which is published in 1985, a guy named Steve Malore wrote a very short story featuring the Uncanny X-Bugs. I do not know a lot about Steve. I've been looking for information. The only thing I can find outside of his Marvel credits is that he also wrote some episodes of Ren and Stimpy. So I truly know not, but like very little about him, but he created a ton of like animal versions of characters. He also did some like Marvel Tales, which is also just a parody of a lot of different things with like backup stories featuring characters like the Illegal Eagle. So just like very silly animal versions. And we love to do this to our characters. We love like Muppet Babies, where we have a baby version, which is the X-Babies, or like the Bamps from Nightcrawler. We love a cutesy kiddies fairy tale moment anytime in our comics. Do you guys like the cutesy side of the X-Men when it shows up?
You haven't had a lot of exposure to this kind of stuff yet, Shawnee, have you? Like, we haven't hit any of that. The X-Babies are always gonna pop out of me. You know. Sorry, it's a wrestling term. I love that stuff. Like, that's those standalone... Kitty's Fairy Tale is a great example. Like, it's a story that it just gives this standalone story that still appeals to kids, you know? And we forget that, like, initially, comic books were a medium for children, and like a lot of kids get into them and learn about themes and continue to engage with them as they mature. But A lot of those, that's if there's something cute on the cover, a kid's going to pick it up. And I like cutesy stuff. Hello Kitty's right behind me on the shelf here. So, you know, I love seeing that kind of stuff, particularly in older comics. I don't know that it translates as easily to a modern writing style.
In our X-Men books, we get characters like Lockheed or Jeff the Land Shark or Alligator Loki or the Banff dolls, or even characters like Dupe or Warlock that kind of fall into this. It's like a Looney Tunes kind of silly energy about them. And that's what Spider-Ham is like, right? If you've seen Into the Spider-Verse, we've got like old aged up Peter Parker, and then we've got Spider-Ham swinging around with his pig nose, right?
Well, yeah, my only exposure, like I've seen Into the Spider-Verse, so I did appreciate the Spider-Ham inclusion there and how they juxtaposed it against the more serious element. But yeah, this was my first real exposure to it. So I'm really only dealing with like the OG forms of the X-Men or Marvel characters to begin with. I haven't really dipped my toe into the wacky cutesy spin-offs yet.
So for context for everybody, and this is way later than some people may think, if you've ever seen the animated films Ants or A Bug's Life, those films did not come out until 1998. This is 1985, so much, much earlier. I was 7. I'm in my late 40s, everyone. I can own it. But this is a book I would have picked up off the shelf. So we're going to mostly just analyze the last 5 pages of Peter Porker, The Spectacular Spider-Ham number 2, which is the Uncanny X-Bugs feature. The tagline, we have little bugs all over the page. It's written and drawn by Steve Malor. They're uncanny. They're bugs. They're hyphenated. Mutant insects banded together for no particular reason. And we open on our 5 feature characters. Beth, will you tell us about Cyclops, who yells on the first panel, "Hurry, X-Men, Professor X-Bug is summoning us telepathically."
Now, I cannot, for the life of me, work out what kind of bug Cyclops is meant to be here, but we have 2 little antennae popping out the top of his mask, because these costumes covering most of his body. It's the standard Cyclops costume, but we got green skin and a very long nose. No wings. So I don't know. Is he some kind of grub or slug or something? He's got arms and legs. I got no clue what Cyclops is meant to be here, but he's...
Are they specific bugs, or are they just like buggy in general?
They're bug-ish. They're bug-like.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Like, I'm looking over at Storm. I'm getting ahead of myself. I'm looking over at Storm over there. I'm like, Storm's got to be a fly, right? But I'm coming back to Cyclops here, and I'm like,
well, they
maybe
all have,
not. Maybe they they're all the antennas, same thing.
They all have antennas and, like, fly eyes. Like, the design of the fly eyes. But then every character is just kind of individually designed. Shani, tell us about Colossus.
Colossus has got his big... big doofy tongue hanging out of his mouth. It's the same sort of thing. He's got his little antenna. He's definitely been, what's the term when a character is like not super intelligent, and so then when they're in a simplified form, they just are complete dumb.
Yeah, he's very like, oh, duh, like through this whole thing. He has also been skipping leg day. He's like big old barrel up top and like teeny tiny waist and teeny tiny legs. Doofy version. I will describe Nightcrawler. Nightcrawler is a little blue Bamfy guy who, instead of Bamfing, he just says poot. Like, he's clearly farting in like every panel. There's a little puff of smoke behind his butt and around him, and the sound effect is poot. So he has like fart powers in this world, but still 3 fingers and 3 toes and like a little teeny mouse tail.
No, I was going to say, I didn't notice that he had his canonical 3 digits. So I like that detail.
Looks like he's like the way that they've laid him out, like the bottom of his blue body almost looks like it's meant to be like a diaper or something. Like, I can't quite work out what's meant to be going on in the illustration there.
Big old buck teeth. He's adorable. Shani, tell us about Wolverine.
Yeah, so Wolverine has a jawline almost as big as Colossus, which is impressive, and he's got massive fists with a little spike on.
My man's all hands. He's like Ludacris in the Move Back video.
He also he has his hands are huge, like the size of his head. He has a weird version of his mask here that's so odd. It just, I don't know. It looks like a character from like Fat Albert, if you look up those characters from the 80s cartoon. And then Beth,
I know the exact character you're talking
about. Yes,
the hat with the eye holes cut out of it.
Yes, that's what it's giving. And then we have our best character, although, wow. Tell us about Storm, Beth.
Well, let's be real. Storm's eating here. We've got a bit of a boob tube. What do you reckon, Shawnee? Like a play suit going on? It doesn't really look like... doesn't look like her standard costume, but we got a bit of a play suit. We got some beautiful white boots. We got the white gloves to match, and she's still got a cape on there. But I will note, she's not wearing her traditional white costume. It's this weird beigey sort of color.
It's giving, she's very buxom. She's like a sexy little green bug with the roundest red mouth and like a little wisp of white hair. They're trying to make her sexy, which is such a weird thing. She's the Smurfette on the team. Odd.
Is this still in the Mohawk Storm era, do you reckon? Put her hair like that?
Well, and this is the costume that matches her Mohawk era. When she's in that like black number where it's like her shoulders and the tops of her boobs are out, you know?
Yeah, this, I definitely agree with you that that's what they're going for here. But again, like they could have colored it in the black leather to make that, apparent. I'm just not getting it, I guess.
So Professor X in this world is an earthworm with glasses and a graduation cap. And okay, that's fine. So they all come screeching to a halt in front of Professor X, who says, "Greetings, X-Bugs. I have an important mission for you." And then he leads them to the insectoscope room. And there's all these little things worked into these panels. Page 2, Storm's boobs are huge as she like leans back. Nightcrawler's reading a True Bug magazine while he farts. They all follow him into the room, and Professor X Bug says, "Our arch enemy, Magsquito, the magnetic mosquito, is on a rampage. We must stop him." And we see a TV screen image of Magsquito, it just sounds like a dirty sex word. Magsquito makes me uncomfortable. He's like just moving metal everywhere.
Yeah, well, to help assist us with his powers, he's got a giant magnet on his head in place of his usual little horns, which is helpful here. He's wearing his classic, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't know like all the classic uniforms, but the purple and red has been pretty consistent from his get-go, right?
Yes, yeah, but this is like his head looks like a bell. There's like a full hat that's like, his nose has like the helmet has a place for his long nose to go, and then there's a magnet on top. Truly wild design. The X-Bugs rush to the X-Buggy, and they see in the bottom corner, hey, look, it's the Micronauts. The Micronauts were huge property at Marvel in the late 80s, so we see versions of the Micronauts in the bottom corner. Colossus fully picks up Cyclops and Storm in this image, and Storm's ass is out, like round and cracked, as Nightcrawler's farting behind her. And Nightcrawler is like smoking a cigarette, this is a wild panel. There's so much going on here.
I'm like, guys, who is Steve, my boy, who is this for? Because I'm looking at like Saucy Storm over here, and I'm like, is this meant to be funny, or is this you thing, dude?
This is very like, this is like Max Fleischer meets R. Crumb. Like that, is that really, if there's a woman character, they're going to be stacked on their chest and their butt.
Transition goals.
Literally, right? But Nightcrawler just like lighting up in the background too. Like every panel here, they're giving Nightcrawler like a new little activity to do.
And it's like, I get that it's a parody comic, but this weird thing about like reading a parody comic from 40 years ago, it's like there's clearly a lot of parodies of stuff from the time, and I don't know whether True Bug magazine is just like something nonsense or if it's a reference to something from the 80s.
Relation to true crime, I suppose.
I assume like 3D movies might have been sort of back at the time, and that's why Nightcrawler's wearing 3D glasses when he's looking at the Magneto screen. Like it's all this weird stuff that like it's a parody of like all things outside the X-Men, but then we've got X-Men doing stuff that isn't like a parody of what their character is necessarily.
It's the weirdest animation with the worst cartoon voices and like really odd transitions. It's like, this would be a terrible cartoon, but we would love it because it's camp. So the X-Bugs all pile into one red car. Nightcrawler farts in every panel. That car is not working, so they switch from an X-Buggy to an X-Checker, which looks more like a taxi cab, from like the taxi cab from Who Framed Roger Rabbit. And as they're driving, there's little bug civilians. One of them is selling a newspaper. Extra, extra. Cyclops says, "Who's the guy waving?" And Storm, who appears to be asleep, says, "That's my ex-boyfriend," as a little bug says, "Hiya, toots." And that man could not get Storm. That's all I'm saying.
Storm would never date this backwards cat fuck boy. Come on.
Come on, dude. Like, if you're gonna put a fit together, it takes more than a hat.
So we move to a scene of magnetic devastation, and we say, X-Bugs, attack. Okay, Shawnee, we have a costume change in this first panel where the X-Bugs are rushing toward Magsquito.
I wasn't really, like, understanding exactly what was happening here. They're all wearing some different accoutrements. Cyclops has got, like, a little Davy Crockett fur cap. Nightcrawler's straight up got a gun with a Rambo
headband.
He's giving Rambo big
still
time.
Farting.
It's still farting. Storm's got like the like Viking-esque sort of helmet. Cyclops has gone full Centurion with it, and Wolverine's just got a pot on his
head. And has a pot on his head. And then they just kick Magsquito's fucking ass. They just lay into him. It's brutal.
Oh, we got Magneto immediately slicing Magsquito up. That feels like it should have come last, because he's fully back together in time for Kurt to poke him in the eyes while still farting. Oh my god, are the farts like the brimstone when he teleports? Is that the joke?
Yep.
Have I only just pieced this together? I'm not cut out for this parody business, Chad. I don't know. Then we got Storm absolutely nuking him out of the sky with a lightning bolt, and we just see Magsquito's face in the lightning bolt. Then we got my boy Slim, my boyfriend, absolutely blowing Magsquito away with a zap. And finally, we get Petey Pureheart bonking him on the head.
Colossus's tongue is out, but he also has like a huge pile of mucus rolling down his chin from his nose. It's so gross. On the final page, Professor X says, "You're finished, Magsquito, now clean up this mess." And he's like, "You idiots, I've gone straight." And he has actually opened a junkyard. He's in the scrap metal business. And they're all astounded, and they run away, whoops, as he throws cans at them, and they're off to a new adventure. Final issue of the Spectacular Spider-Ham. In the latter half, there's a lot of, like, fat shaming in this universe. If you read the earlier tale, it's uncomfortable. I don't love that.
I read it. I did not care for it.
Yeah, 80s humor. Not my favorite. But in the end of this one, the backup story, also by Mike Malore and Steve Malore, so presumably brothers, this is The Secret Furs, which is a parody of The Secret Wars. We have characters like Dr. Doom and Iron Mouse. So there's all these different characters running around in a world where Hulk Bunny, who is Bruce Banner in his other form, is kind of leading everyone into the world where the Bee Yonder lives. And we have another bug character. I don't know if Shawnee knows at all who the Bee Yonder is. It's a godlike character who pulls all the heroes into a crazy adventure in the 80s. So Secret Furs is a playoff of Secret Wars. Now, I'm just going to point out some silly moments here. We have the Luke Cage, who looks like Goofy here, pounding Magsquito's hat down. We see a magazine called The Play Bee, which is presumably naked bees, like in the form of Playboy. We see a cartoon version of the Hate Monger yanking out Captain America's tongue. Truly just some wild shit. We're gonna kind of skip through a lot of this. Everybody's fighting, everybody's acting crazy. And then the Beyonder opens a television show where he's interviewing different guests, like Dr. Octopussycat, which is a cute version of that. You'll notice to his left is Daredevil, and in front of him, the King Pig, and Croctor Doom, the alligator Dr. Doom over off to the side. We finally land where he's interviewing Colossus, and we have a Kitty Bug who shows up here. Shawnee, do you know who Kitty Pryde is?
Yes, I'm loosely familiar with Kitty Pryde based on...
So infamously, Claremont has like 13-year-old Kitty Pryde fall in love with like 18, 19-year-old Colossus all through the 80s. It's like a kind of an uncomfortable romance for people to read about now, but that's being played off of here.
Yeah, so this was something... When we first started into the Claremont era, I was like, oh, I love Colossus. He's such a sweetie. Like, yeah, he's too protected of Storm, but like his heart's in the right place. And Beth was just like giving me this little like, yeah, he is, isn't he, the whole time. And I just had to get it out of her about this storyline that happened. So now I'm not looking forward to this coming. But yeah, we have Colossus here. He's saying that, Kitty, I want you to run away with me. And Kitty wants to, but is saying they can't because of how jealous Aurora Bug and Wolverine Bug are.
So now things get weird. Like, yeah, they start kissing and then weirder versions of Wolverine and Storm walk in. Wolverine apparently is dating Sprite and Aurora is apparently dating Colossus. So they get in a big fight and end up with black eyes. And then the Dazzler, the Bee Dazzler shows up singing some weird song with a chainsaw and a microphone in her hand. And then we have a cute little like Fozzie Bear version of the Thing beating up Dr. Doom. It just goes crazy here.
Okay. Well, first of all, and I said this when I was messaging you, I love the Dazzler outfit. Out of all these X-Bugs, Bee Dazzler... And Bee Dazzler, brilliant name, is the cutest, and she gets one panel. I can't tell if the song is a parody of something.
I don't think so. I looked it up.
Yeah, it's, I don't know, but it's, you know, it's that cool kind of like more rock and roll outfit that she had, you know, as we came out of the disco era, but with their own twist. The whole, I get that we're playing on the X-Men soap opera tendencies here. That's what we're parodying, but... Like, the parody that doesn't necessarily reflect, like, the dynamic of the comic takes something that is, like, I'm not sure that, like, because this is, when's this one? 1986, if the other one's 1985.
Yeah, yeah.
Thereabouts. Like, it really seemed like, at the time, now we look back at Colossus and Kitty, and we're like, yeah, that's gross, and it makes it really icky to read. It seems like, at the time, from everything I've read back then, nobody really thought twice about it back then. So, I don't know necessarily that they're criticizing the Kitty and Peter relationship, even though they should be, but they've decided to make it even weirder by...
But he also has the worst design. She's just like a little, like in a skinny black suit.
Yeah. She's just got little shaggy hair. She's not even like a superhero outfit. But, you know, at the time, was she in her like blue jumpsuit sort of...
Probably.
Era? Yeah. It's like, but I feel like these got drawn very quickly.
Unpopular theory. Do you think that the Bee Dazzler was the lead model in the Play Bee this month in the Bee world? We have nude Bee Dazzler in the magazine.
She's got a bee. We don't have any other bee
representation. She's got a bee.
Here.
Yeah.
Boo.
My girl's spinning a lot of plates. But you know what? If that's what she's got to do, you know what? Nothing but respect for you, Daz. You do whatever you got to do. Yeah, just this whole dynamic in this scene is weird. It's like, Shawnee and I were talking about this last night when we went out for dinner. We're like, the whole, like, the parodies in these issues, it's got, like, Mad Magazine energy.
Yep.
And, like, we both tried to read Mad Magazine as teenagers, and we're like, I think it's funny, that's why I'm reading it, but I can't actually think of what, like, I don't actually think that it is funny. It's like, there's jokes, but I'm not laughing.
It is not meant for deep analysis. This is the one we're going to spend the most time on, but I want to jump into two other animal worlds quickly. One of them is Alligator Loki.
What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage 1. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Prenuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
If you guys watch the Loki series, there's an alligator alternate version of him that shows up there. And then my dear friends Alyssa Wong and Bob Quinn get to launch the series on Marvel Infinity. One of the closing issues, and they're just having fun in this kind of wordless comic. The premise is that Loki has Alligator Loki as his pet, very Jeff the Land Shark, and it's just the series of misadventures on Earth 22311, which is the official designation for the alligator world. Now, in this, we open on a lot of very cute art. The title of the story is All Alligators, so like everyone belongs. And Alligator Loki is coloring some pictures of different kinds of characters. Now, Shani, on the third page, we see him design some very cute versions in crayon of our favorite characters. Do you want to talk about these?
Yes, I do.
Weirdly, like the same lineup.
So up the top, we have a proud little Thor alligator. And down the bottom, we've got our little Colossus and Nightcrawler alligator. And next to them, of course, Wolverine and Scott Summers.
And do you like these little alligator versions?
I love them. I am a huge fan. Everything reptiles. I always have. My like favorite thing to draw when I was little was snakes and lizards and stuff. So this is really scratching a particular itch.
We go to the next page and we have Captain Marvel, Iron Man, Iron Fist, Psylocke, which is a little cute purple sword one. Hawkeye,
and her
Captain
little
American.
Butterfly telepathy coming around her head too, like the little representation of her telepathy. It's that's so cute. That and little image of Alligator Loki with his little like flattened crayon because he's used so much green.
Yes.
Melts my heart. That's so adorable.
It's very
yes,
cute.
Ill.
Bob Quinn, the artist of this book, has been on my show many times. He's wonderful. He's so fucking funny. We see images of like Scarlet Witch, Spider-Man, and Beast poking up. And then Loki's like, oh, look at this world where Alligator Loki wants to be. And so he opens a portal because in the multiverse, this is a thing at Marvel. If you tell a story, it exists out there somewhere in another universe. Like it just becomes part of the storyverse. So they jump into a world where all of these characters exist. And Shani, talk to us about some of your favorite moments. This is wordless. It's very cute as all the little hero alligators interact.
It is, and they are all fabulous. My favorites have gotta be little Doctor Strange one, still with his little mustache and goatee, looking hilarious on the face of an alligator. See, I love Nightcrawler because he's just like a little blue alligator, but my favorite one on this page is Cyclops because he looks so happy. If there was a little
and we never see him happy.
No! He's finally in alligator world, he's found peace.
But when Loki and Alligator Loki step in, there's like a giant Odin alligator that like ruins their fun. He's like Loki's dad, right? And he's like, rah! Humans and alligators don't mix together. And they're like, rah! And they're yelling at each other wordlessly.
The little alligator crows that are following you around. They're my favorite thing in this whole issue.
We have moments of delight. Shani has hands on face going,
this whole thing.
So Odin ruins everything. Loki has to take little Loki, Alligator Loki, back to home where Thor and Frog Thor are waiting to give him some comfort. And Alligator Loki puts a picture of the four of them on the fridge to close out the issue. Adorable story. I love these little Alligator Loki comics, but there's Alligator X-Men out there.
It's the long torsos for me. Seeing the little Alligator X-Men in their costumes, but they got these big long torsos because they're alligators. I don't know. It's just so funny. The little Nightcrawler has this smug little smile on his face. I don't know. I just, my heart's melting from the cuteness. You know, it's just like, that was like a beautiful 5 minutes of my life reading this comic.
Okay, last one. And we're going to focus primarily on the X-Men characters in this one. So not a super long discussion, but there's a world out there that exists called Earth 8101, which is the Marvel Apes verse where everyone is an ape. And it first shows up in 2008. There is a little known mutant called the Gibbon, who's a Spider-Man character. I've done a Gibbon episode for those that might want to go listen for more. His name is Marty Blank. He gets transported into a world where he is not the only monkey person because he's a monkey mutant and everyone's a monkey. And using terms that you guys like very much, this is a very metal book because things go very quickly crazy. More puns. For example, we have the Ape Avengers in this world. And there are worlds where if a human woman is here, like this woman, Fiona Fitzhugh, she is hideous because she looks like a human and everyone else is a monkey. Then we get zombie versions of Nazi ape characters in the form of old invaders coming back to like turn everyone in this ape verse against each other. It ends up bleeding into our world. So there's a 4-issue limited series and then a whole bunch of one-shots that follow this. And the ape verse has been visited multiple times, including with one of Spider-Man parody, who's called the Spider Monkey here, who has teamed up with like Spider-Ham and Spider-Man in our main universe. Before we get to some of the X-Men parodies, Beth, you seem to particularly enjoy this kind of denser series. Talk to everybody about what you loved about the Marvel Apes line by Carl Kessel and Ramon Box.
When I messaged you this, when I just started reading it, I'd read like the first issue and I'm like, what the hell, Chad? Like, why is this a good comic? Because it is so like story dense, like, and for starters, it really made me sympathize with Gibbon. Like, it's because he's, you know, I love a character who's a character who's done bad things in the past and is trying to redeem himself. And
Gibbon is one of Marvel's earliest mutants. He's an old Spider-Man character, but he's never had anything to do with the X-Men.
It's, and just every time I turned a page, like, I'm like, of course that's happening. It makes perfect sense with the setup. Like, the setup in this comic is really good, that it kind of pays off everything as it goes. I will say, though, a lot of the ape puns, they're just so invested in the fact that I guess apes say ook, like, okay, and a lot of the puns are just like, ooh, Dr. Octopus. Like, that's, the puns aren't fantastic, but the story, very enjoyable.
The roster of the Ape Avengers is Ms. Marvape, Iron Mandrill, Thorangatang, Spider Monkey, a character named Ape X, who does exist in our world now, Speedball, which is wild, who also came over to our world, Hawk Ape, and then just the Vision and the Wasp. There's a couple of other parody characters. One of the funniest ones in the Fantastic Four, the Human Torch is the Simian Torch, which is hilarious to me.
That's a good one.
And then we meet the X-Simians, which is a ape version of all of the X-Men. And all of them just have regular names. Cyclops, Iceman, Beast, Psylocke, Nightcrawler, Storm. But the only one that has a different name is Colossus. Instead of Colossus, we have Colossus. And they're kind of in the background. They're not a huge piece of the story. The one that's the larger character through this series is the Wolverine ape, who is also running around helping them fight the Nazis. Wild, wild journey. There's one famous image of the Wolverine ape who is in a tree with like curved hands and feet, and instead of claws, he has bananas. I don't know.
Is that one of the like variant covers that are the issue zero? Yeah. But reading through like the main story, the main miniseries, the ape Wolverine plays a role, you know, in the story. Swear to God, like, he pretty much just looks like Wolverine. Like, this design, like for the most part, yeah, I would, if you told me that was normal Wolverine in amongst all the apes, I'd believe you.
He just kind of has a monkey face and the regular costume on.
When he's always scowling too, it's not like you can't, he's always pulling the same face when he's regular Wolverine too. It's like, you can't necessarily tell. I'll note, like, Nightcrawler, like, seems to be some, this is at the end of, I want to say, issue 2, like, seems to be some different kind of monkey. He's got a bit more of like that longer baboon face, I guess, while all the others just have that kind of generic ape face that most of the apes in this universe have.
Were you a little gagged by the reveal that the Nazi invader monkeys were zombies?
I will say that I loved it. Just bonkers.
In issue 3, we have a backup story that plays again off of Secret Wars. The Watcher, who's also an ape, is like watching the Beyonder mess with the heroes. And we do have a wider shot where we get like New Mutants versions of the apes, but they're all in the background. There's a Rachel Summers, Magneto, Cannonball, Warlock, Wolvesbane, Mirage, Rogue. They're all just kind of in a group shot, but they're canonically in this world. And then they get involved in a slightly larger battle with the Beyonder, but not a lot happens. It's a quick two-pager, but there's canonically the New Mutants apes as well. And I don't know if Shawnee even knows who the New Mutants are, so just toss that your way.
Wolfsbane gets a little bit of dialogue, though. Like, she introduces herself as Wolfsbane. She still has a Scottish accent, but yeah, she's got a little bit of dialogue talking to, what's the Iron Man's name? Iron Mandrill.
Iron Mandrill, yeah.
Yeah.
And then in the backup of issue 4, we get a wild story where the Watcher pulls some characters from different timelines. From 2099, which is the Marvel Future Properties line, we have Nick Fury, Doctor Strange, Ghost Rider, and then a Jean Grey ape, who's also very busty. We've got a redheaded ape woman. She cries a little bit. They're fighting Grey Lactus. It's very Planet of the Apes. It's a kind of a silly story also. Not a ton going on here, but if you needed an Ape Galactus fighting a Phoenix ape, here's your story for you.
Like, are they... Like, I don't know much about the 2099 universe, right? I've read a bit of the Spider-Man, but like, is this Fantastic Four 2099 that they're showing in the actual 2099 universe?
No.
Is the okay, this is completely made up.
Yeah, they're just bringing a bunch of shit together for reasons. I truly don't understand what the purpose of this particular story is.
Okay, firstly, Nick Fury, insane name for the Nick Fury parody. Also, Nick Fury is a woman in this ape universe. So Nick Fury, she's on the back of ape Ghost Rider 2099's rocket cycle. That's just in a little sports bra and an eye patch. But you know, she kept her dead name as her trans name, I guess.
Nick Fury. So I want to spend a little bit of time on the variant covers, which is the weirdest thing. So when Marvel Apes came out, every comic book being published in 2008 in a certain month by Marvel got a variant ape cover. And we're going to focus mostly on the X-Men ones, but if you guys want to point out any of them, that's fine. We have to talk about Cable number 6, which is a parody of the first appearance of Cable when he shows up in New Mutants and like the heads of the characters that he's impacting are all around and like reacting. But in this version, everyone is an ape. And then we have like the ape New Mutants in the top corner box looking down. This is a variant cover of Cable number 6 by Liefeld, and it's wild, but the Boom Boom ape in particular is really jarring.
I was gonna say, she ate with that lipstick.
She's having a bad day, folks.
And hey, Boom Boom is an all-timer for me. I freaking love Boom Boom. Look, my girl, you know, she's a monkey, but she still wanted to take some time to get the makeup nice. Good on you, girl.
We go a couple more pages. We have a variant of Captain Britain in the MI-13 number 5, where we have a giant Captain Britain, like King Kong, grabbing Megan and climbing up Big Ben.
Absolute chaos. I did not know who this was, who any of these characters were, the fact that it's in Britain and also but I'm loving every second of it.
I freaking loved Captain Britain in MI-13 too when it was coming out. Like, that was a sick comic. Dracula lives in a castle on the moon and fires vampires at Earth from a space pirate ship out of like the cannons. It's completely insane.
We've been doing script readings with an all-British queer cast of the early Captain Britain 70s books. If you guys want to go listen on my show, wildly fun. It's a good time. I want to spend a moment on Incredible Hercules parody from 121. There's a Hercules ape dreaming about Namora throwing him a banana split, which is just truly a wildly stupid cover. We get Wolverine in a bunch of group shots. There's some Daredevils. There's some classic parodies. There's a Moon Knight. One that's another that I want to point out is Ms. Marvel number 31 cover, which is the evolutionary chart with Carol Danvers slowly turning into an ape woman. So it's the evolution in reverse.
The Darwinian factor is funny. We can't have apes without mentioning They mention in the main Marvel Apes plotline, I forget, like someone saying like, God help us or something, but they say Darwin help us. So canonically Darwin is God in this universe, which is interesting.
Oh my God, that made me think of one of my favorite lines from the Marvel Apes miniseries, like right in the last issue. Back on Earth, Speedball has come back to Earth with Marty and the scientists. And Marty says something about, you know, we have a saying on this planet that 100 monkeys on 100 typewriters could write Shakespeare. Shakespeare. And Speedball says, yeah, well, on my world, it just took one.
Monkey Shakespeare.
So Monkey Shakespeare, Monkey Darwin, it all comes together. It's freaking incredible.
I'm still getting to know you, but Beth, I'm assuming the She-Hulk orangutan weightlifting at the gym is giving particular Beth vibes somehow.
You know, I've only just got into like really working out. So, you know, maybe I can get She-Hulk buff. Who knows?
And then, Shawnee, let's go a little farther. We have this image of Wolverine I talked about with the banana claws.
Oh, yeah, it's fantastic. He's got his banana claws, which, what are they going to do? He's got some real sharp teeth here as well in a real scowl. Those bananas are just going to mash against anybody he swipes at. But I haven't mentioned it. It's come up on our pod. I love puns. I'm still in joke jail for joking about how Colossus has an iron lung. So any pun, any pun, any substitution of a banana for a claw. Because there's another moment in the issue where Nick Fury is like meant to be smoking a cigar, but he's just got a banana hanging out of his mouth as well. I love it.
So go to the next one. We have a parody of X Factor 35 by Boo Cook, which
yes.
is a multiple man parody that's an actual cover, but it's a multiple man ape. They do have the M tattoos over their eyes, and it's just every clone of multiple man.
Madrox, that's the worst boy alive who I just love unconditionally. God, X Factor Investigations, that was... As that comic was coming out, I was mad for it. So clearly this is like after Madrox has like ended up in Bishop's future and been imprisoned and come back. And then after that, for the rest of the run, he had the M tattoo on his eye. So it's pitching it in the run. But like looking at this cover, there's a cute little monkey ape Madrox just up in the top left hand corner, just poking onto the screen from the very corner and giving a little wave. That feels like me. I love a photo.
I'm the one in the like the middle that's like chewing on his own fingers. Very contemplative.
Yeah, I like that. I'm definitely on the far left in the middle of the page with a little tongue hanging out. Because like any excuse for like when I'm chucking a pose, like got to get the tongue out there. So that's me.
It's Colossus Bug as a Madrox ape variant. we then go to the Young X-Men number 6 cover variant. This is a wild series by Mark Guggenheim. We have Anole, Rockslide, Dust, Donald Pierce posing as Cyclops. And then I think those two in the front are supposed to be Gray Malkin and Cypher. So I think it's Gray Malkin and Cypher. It might be Wolf Cub and Cypher. But they're picking lice out of, one's picking lice out of the other's hair. Just wild. Wild journey this whole time. How are we feeling as we've reviewed these bizarre animal parodies of our favorite characters? Do we have any favorites? I had you guys on for a stupid episode.
Just I'm here for the plot, I'm here for the lore, and I'm here for the thrill. So anytime somebody goes to me, I'm gonna draw every Marvel character as an ape, I'm like, go off, gang. Just do it. And I keep saying I had the best time with the ape.
I think like, because coming into this, it was wild enough that it's like, oh yeah, they're Marvel characters, but they're all apes. Not only are they apes, they are vampire apes. So it's adding a whole new element to it. So I had a great time with this whole
ride. Vampire Nazi apes, even.
Vampire Nazi apes as well, as if it wasn't enough. But favorite, like I have to say that like the Ghost Rider ape, just being a flaming skull, but it's just like an ape skull. I thought that was
okay. If you brought one X-Men parody into the main Marvel universe to join the team from our reviews today, which one character would you bring over?
Be Dazzler, and it's not even close, because I have a complicated relationship with Dazzler. If we have an alternate version of her on the team, that's a cute little bee. Maybe we'll see.
Shawnee?
It's gotta be Ape Wolverine. I want to see normal Wolverine and Ape Wolverine constantly in competition with each other.
I kind of want Magsquito to make his way over. I feel like this indestructible magnetic bug would wreak all kinds of chaos, but really my choice is Aurora Bug. I want to see Storm react to the little sexy bug version of herself. It would be a hilarious story for me. My last question for you two, if you were to write an X-Men animal parody in Australia, it could be like the X-Men as kangaroos versus the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants as koalas? Do we have ideas here? Am I selling you?
Yeah, it's one of these things that whenever a band tours Australia, they will put on their tour t-shirt like a koala or a kangaroo or a platypus or something. And they're like, I'm selling this shirt with Australian animals on it to Australians. And I'm like, gang, I live here. I don't, it's for you that the band t-shirt has a kangaroo on it. I don't need Blink 182 Australian tour with an emu and a Tasmanian devil. Actually, if it had a Tasmanian devil, that'd be dope.
Yeah, no,
but that's like, I'm confused about the question.
Give me a quokka instead.
That's it. Like, have fun with it. Where are the bilbies? Where are the thylacines?
This is the thing about kangaroos too, because they're so quintessentially Australian, because they are everywhere. Like, granted, I live a bit more rurally, but there are frequently kangaroos in my backyard. Like, they're a very, very common animal.
So kind of like a white-tailed deer for people in the States. Yeah, I heard.
Yeah, you feel like if you wrote an Australian animal parody, it's not for Australians. They're not going to want it. So
if we make it that they're all snake, like forget alligator Loki, I want to see everyone is snake. Australia has a lot of different types of snakes. How do they get around without arms? Interesting plot point. That's what I'm going to go for.
Snakes with visors, snakes with claws. Yep.
Exactly.
The villains, all Australia's most deadly spiders.
Snakes versus spiders.
Yes, we have the funnel web, we'll have the white tail, we'll have the red back.
Red back.
The huntsman is ultimately harmless.
Yeah.
I have adored hanging out with you both today. I think you're hilarious and delightful, and I'm really happy to see you joining this like fun little queer X-Men sub-community of nerds. We're going to put this out in mid-March on the show. Tell everybody where they can find you online. Is there anything you'd like to plug? And do you have any final thoughts?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think Beth can jump off this, but we're always going to be plugging our music as of March.
Yeah, it's Shawnee likes to put me in charge of the projects. We always got a scheme bubbling. Yeah, by March, I don't think we're going to have like any new music out, but you know what? We put out two albums as Beth Seymour and the Lizzies at the end of last year. You Wouldn't Like It Inside My Head and Outside You Love Me to Death. And that's only a few months ago. So anyone out there, probably going to be people listening to this who haven't heard of us before, like go listen to our two albums. I promise you they are really good. X-Men podcast, wherever you find podcasts. We're not just on YouTube anymore. We are everywhere. So give us a listen and hear us say some even sillier things than the stuff that we probably said today. We always get caught up in the thrill of the moment, and just keep your eyes peeled.
Tame on this episode, if that says anything about our show.
Probably.
Yeah, we were talking about little cutesy bugs. I get it. we're raunchy on my show too, I promise.
We often like film right at the end of the day. Like we'll start filming at like 8 p.m. and we both do a lot in a day. So by the time we get to the end of it, like your girls, they're just bonkers. And
loopy.
Just going off on absolute tangents, like the most recent episode that went up yesterday. I know that'll be months ago by the time this comes out, but it's like, you know, we just went on a whole tangent about my childhood football career. So there we
guys,
are.
And the clip you posted just a couple of days ago where you're like, the Soul Drinker! And I was like,
yes.
Shawnee loves anytime something's a bit metal.
Follow the show at graymalkin_land on Instagram, most prominently. I keep my own social media private because I've got kiddos. The two of you are welcome to follow me. Just ask. The show's going to end this month, gimmick month in March, with, I always do, you guys, a big academic trial or panel at the end of the month. It's like my big macro episode. So the end of this month is going to be gimmicky villains. The characters Rampage and Stiltman are getting the feature on the show. And then April, the theme for the whole month is going to be gay cowboys. So it's going to get real queer up in here. We're going to have a great time.
Hell yeah.
Shawnee and Beth, what a delight to hang out with you both. Thank you for your time and talents. I can't wait to hang out again.
Yes, stay blessed. Thanks for having us.
All right, everybody. Take care of yourselves in this crazy world. It's dangerous out there. Be safe. Live joyfully. We will see you all back here next time on the Gray Malkin Lane Show. And now stay tuned for some thoughts on fascism as a special guest and I talk about a Red Skull story and its modern applications. I haven't talked yet today. Okay. Julius Streicher was born in 1885 in Bavaria and trained as a school teacher before World War I. He served in the German army during the war and was decorated for bravery, an experience that deepened his nationalist and anti-Semitic convictions. After Germany's defeat, he became active in far-right politics during the volatile years of the Weimar Republic. Streicher joined Adolf Hitler's movement in the early 1920s and took part in the failed beer hall putsch of 1923, which we've talked about on the show before. Unlike some early Nazis who later distanced themselves from Hitler, Streicher remained intensely loyal and was rewarded with influence in Franconia, where he became Gauleiter or regional party leader. In 1923, Streicher founded the weekly newspaper Der Stürmer, S-T-U-R-M-E-R. The publication became notorious for its graphic caricatures and obsessive anti-Semitic rhetoric. It portrayed Jews as criminals, sexual predators, parasites, and existential enemies of Germany. Its style was crude and sensational, often featuring lurid illustrations and fabricated stories. While not an official government paper, Der Stürmer operated with Hitler's protection and was displayed publicly in glass cases known as Stürmerkasten, so that even those who did not purchase it would see its headlines and cartoons. Streicher's writing was not subtle or intellectual. It was designed to inflame emotion and normalize hostility. During the 1930s, as the Nazi regime consolidated power, Streicher continued publishing increasingly extreme content. Though he did not hold a central administrative role in implementing the Holocaust, his paper consistently advocated for the removal of Jews from German society and later openly called for their annihilation. Over time, even some within the Nazi party regarded him as embarrassing for his corruption and vulgarity. In 1940, he was removed from his position as Gauleiter after accusations of financial misconduct. What a surprise. But he remained personally loyal to Hitler and continued publishing Der Stürmer until near the end of the war. After Germany's defeat in 1945, Streicher was arrested and brought before the International Military Tribunal at Nuremberg. He was not charged with direct participation in military planning or camp administration. Instead, prosecutors focused on his sustained incitement to persecute and exterminate through propaganda. The tribunal concluded that his persistent public calls for destruction of Jews constituted crimes against humanity. Streicher was convicted and executed in October 1946, a surprise ending to this story. His case became one of the clearest examples in modern legal history of a propagandist held criminally responsible for the consequences of sustained hate-driven incitement. Now we're going to jump to the world of Uncanny Avengers. This is a Rick Remender book, post Avengers versus X-Men, where we mix some Avengers and X-Men work together. There are some infamous moments in this series. Say what you will about a Rick Remender series, this is a pretty fucking good book, and there's some big amplified threats. We open with some quotes. "There is nothing surprising about the mutants' behavior. With their ranks culled, they took extreme measures to rectify imminent extinction. Evolution is no whisper humming in the background. It's the true substance of our every motive. It is natural to safeguard one's lines from environmental competition. Ah, but now the world has seen, felt the mutant boot on its neck, watched as mutants endangered all life to ensure their own propagation. People do not fear tyranny. Believe me, mankind will come for your people. Their hatred for you is too primal, too compelling to be denied. Hatred is natural. Hatred protects species from complacency in the face of its rivals. It reminds you of one simple truth. Kill them before they kill you." We also get, "Failure has always stemmed from looking to an outside source. They will not be able to take this weapon from my grip. I will be one with the power, with the brain of Charles Xavier. The Red Skull will eradicate the mutant menace." In a horrifying beginning to this new series, the Red Skull cuts open the corpse of Xavier, who was just killed by Cyclops with the Phoenix Force, and removes his mutant brain. He grafts it to his own, presumably Artem Zola was involved, and he assembles a brand new team of evil Nazi mutants called the S-Men. I almost covered these guys when I did my shows last November on threats, on Nazi-themed threats. These are mutants who believe in his cause, named the Goat-Faced Girl, the Living Wind, the Insect, Mz, the Turtle Guy, Dancing Water, and maybe the most dangerous, Honest John, who can basically be living propaganda. So using these propaganda powers, the Red Skull stokes anti-mutant fervor through the news networks, increasing acts of violence against mutants across the world. He has Scarlet Witch stabbed and captured. He taunts her, claiming that he knows about Magneto during the war, war and how he wished he had devoted his life to wiping him out. To me, 1942 was mere months ago. Hitler was meth addicted, true, unhinged. I begin to suspect we would lose the war. In preparation, my chief science officer, Arnim Zola, recorded my consciousness within a cloned body, preserved in a bunker to revive in 70 years when the world had forgotten me and my perceived atrocities. So we're led to believe this is a clone of the original Red Skull rather than the Red Skull himself. I woke to an all too familiar world stage. In America, I saw the same embers that burned in Germany before the war. A frightened population of totem worshippers living in decline, flinching at shadows, or hungrily looking for someone to blame. Mutants are the ultimate invading foreigners. And he tries mentally influencing the Scarlet Witch into working with him to wipe out all mutants, but Rogue is there, and she escapes captivity, and they find the brainless corpse of Xavier, and the Red Skull and his S-Men attack. Citizens, fellow human beings, I implore you, wake up. You walk by this monument of death, and it suffocates your hearts. It fills you with a terrible fear. Who among us will be next? There can be no safety living among creatures that bring down buildings without warning. But what can we do? What is the solution? You are the solution. You are the chemotherapy needed to eradicate this cancer growing in our midst. You've heard the stories of everyday men and women taking it upon themselves to remove mutants from their neighborhoods, removing them the only way possible, eradicating them like vermin. You anxiously hold on to hope that this bloodshed will end and peace will find a way. It will not. It cannot. These mutants will attack again and again until we are dead. To me, my S-Men, bring to me the villainous architects responsible for this heinous attack. Let these good people hear for themselves. Rise up, stand and be counted. I unlock in you the sight. Look close. You can see the vile X gene in their blood. You are mankind's defenders. White blood cells. Go forth. Hunt and kill the foreign mutations. And the word white. This is crazy. All that is necessary for the triumph of evil is that good men do nothing. He's bastardizing an anti-Nazi quote. We will do something right now. We will protect ourselves and take back our future. Okay. I know I only covered parts of this story, but let me welcome my friend Daniel Wilson to talk about Uncanny Avengers. Numbers 1-3. What a wild journey. Daniel, welcome, my friend. Are you a Red Skull fan?
Oh my God, I love him. He's such an aspiration. No, not at all. Get him in the bin, get him in the sea, get him into space. He needs to, like, I would go as far as to say he's that one of the few sort of Marvel villains that when he shows up in a book, I see him there and I'm like, well, immediately, I can't wait until you get your face punched in. Like, I don't want to hear what you've got to say because what you've got to say is bullshit, frankly. Like, it's beyond outdated, and it's just terrifying that we're sort of hearing that rhetoric coming around again, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, so this book's over 20 years old at this point, which is crazy. And reading this...
Don't say that. That dates me. That ages me so badly.
Oh, no. I think it's about 10 years old, actually.
That's a little better.
I remember reading this. It's very smartly written, even though it's very, very... This is the series where Alex is like, I'm not a mutant. I'm just Alex. And like,
Dude, first of all, I think it's a fantastic premise. I think it was... I remember even thinking at the time, like, it was a book I was really excited for because it did feel a little bit like, after so long of the X-Men being this endangered species, of being this sort of, where's the respect? Can we put some respect on the name, please? Obviously, I would have preferred Cyclops not to have been thought of as a murderer at the time. That would have been wonderful. But it was sort of that nod, that acknowledgement. And as much as I really liked it, I do remember thinking all the way through this run, I was like, where's the physically mutated mutant? Where's the visibly mutated mutant in this team? So it does feel still very PR, very spin. There's a lot of that. Even in this early sort of like intro kind of thing to it, it does feel like a very, very safe lineup, but a safe lineup can be good. Like I said, I remember being excited for the book because it had, you know, two of my favorite characters in it, Rogue, Scarlet Witch. Fantastic. Let's go.
It's a crazy fun lineup, and the character moments in it are really powerful, and it takes huge swings. We go to the Apocalypse Twins and then the Axis event, and all of the action is really, really crazy. Some really good character moments for all of the characters. It's smartly written. And even if it's not people's favorite sometimes. Reading this in 2026 hits a little different, however. The walking propaganda with these disenfranchised, like, racist mutants, it's like, oh no.
it's one of those things as well. I mean, obviously looking at it, I mean, you as an American will be looking at it through the lens of, like, this does not feel a million miles away from what we hear from the right, you know, in America. But similarly, as somebody British, that sort of hits a little bit for me as well. It feels a lot sort of like the culture that we've got going on here at the minute, where there's a lot of sort of anti-immigration, a lot of anti-trans, a lot of anti-LGBTQ stuff building. And it does feel very, very sort of prescient in a way. It feels really quite scary that we're reading a comic from 10 years ago and we're actually seeing some of this in in real life, obviously without the superpowers. But, you know, you've got this thing of like, well, society's shit. Everything's shit in the world. We need somebody to blame. Who can we blame? And it just hits that mark a little bit too close for home at the moment, I feel. And I'm assuming you feel similarly.
Yeah. You know, the character Honest John as the walking propaganda alone is really interesting. Honest John, that phrase got its origins in like England in like the 17th century, kind of meaning like someone who's very plain spoken and trustworthy, but it went tongue in cheek at a certain point. So at a certain point, it becomes a kind of shorthand for like the guy that says, trust me, but you shouldn't trust him. And for modern audiences, if you remember when Pinocchio is getting drawn up to the land where he gets turned into the donkey, the guy that pulls him away, which is basically a child trafficking story, the guy that pulls him away is Honest John, the fox guy. So seeing this character as kind of this like weaselly propaganda spreader, while we see the influence of the Red Skull with Xavier's brain, truly wild storytelling. Mm. But again, very smart.
I really, really enjoyed the Rogue Wanda stuff. So obviously they get separated quite early on from the bulk of the team. I mean, there's not even a team at the point where they're sort of absconded with. But we've got that really nice sort of playoff with Rogue telling Wanda, just you get the fuck away from Xavier's grave. You don't deserve to be here for him, kind of thing. And then obviously Wanda's in a monologue prior. That is her very much being very respectful, very reverent, and sort of like, you know, did you ever think I would be at your grave, the daughter of your enemy, kind of thing. And then obviously the bit later on when, you know, that in the Red Skull's captivity and he's talking to Wanda, and it's his initial sort of thought panel where he's referring to her as, you know, the Jew and the Gypsy. And you're just sort of like, it is wild to me that this guy who is just Nazi through and through is okay with talking to somebody of both Jewish and Romani heritage. Not that she's colored that way in these issues, but we'll get to that. That's another matter. But you know, he's approaching this woman who is two things that he despises, but he's okay to use her as a weapon. And it's just like that to me is just another layer of how awful he is as a person, a fictional character, obviously.
She's a Romani woman and and the daughter of Magneto, all in one. And crazy.
It's just such a wild take. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it's almost like he might as well have just walked up to her and gone, you're emblematic of everything that I hate for no real reason that I'm an idiot. Fancy killing some people for me. And, you know, obviously with the brain powers of Xavier, she's just sort of like, okay, sure, why not? But that's not her. That's not her. We can forgive her for that one. But yeah, it's just, I really love the Rogue and Wanda bits. They just hit a bit differently. Additionally, the Captain America deferring to Havoc, I remember reading it at the time and thinking, this feels so jarring, this feels so strange. But then I guess you've got Wolverine backing up Havoc, which again feels like a wild take until you remember the Meltdown book from God knows how many years ago that was.
Right, go back and see the trial of Alex Summers on my show. Alex is the company man no matter what. Alex, choice for Captain America. Alex was the public face of mutants working for the government during like Operation Zero Tolerance era. He was the white guy running the team for Valerie Cooper. He was the yes man. And Wolverine at this point has done a lot of stuff with Captain America and the Avengers, and he's kind of playing the long game. And it's a really fun cast of characters. It's again very smartly written. And the S-Men, as awful as they are, is a really fun team. They're visually stunning. They kind of give me Marauders vibes. It's just a group of kind of international reprehensible people, and they're cool in an interesting way. I would love to do more conversations about the S-Men sometime.
They crack me up so much. Like the initial thing where she's like, what was it, your gifts are gone under the gaze of the goat-faced girl, and you just sort of like, who talks like that, my love? Who talks like that? Who empowered you so to be so bold with your speech?
There's all these great moments too, like they're based in Avengers Mansion, but Rogue like hangs up a big picture of Charles Xavier at the main hall. Like there's some really fun moments in this series. Highly recommended. We're going to be spending a little bit of time in my next few Red Skull conversations following up on this story, including in the next episode where Alex Segura is going to join me to talk about issue 4, which is a very large Red Skull story. I opened with the idea of Julius Stryker and his kind of anti-Jewish messages. This man was executed as a war criminal who did horrible, horrible things. It's interesting for me to try to think of the modern equivalent for that. Like in America, I almost want to say it would be like Steve Bannon in the early Trump presidency, using Breitbart to kind of throw out these propagandist messages. In England, I don't know if you would consider this the same, but like in the Boris Johnson cabinet, I don't know if like Dominic Cummings would qualify, or that's a lot. It's a big statement from my mouth.
No, it is, but it's exactly that. It's like he thought that he sorry, I could talk about this bit for ages. He actually was, so you know the whole controversy with him? I was living in that area at that time, like where he came up to get his eyes tested during a lockdown.
If you want to talk about it briefly, many listeners may not be aware.
Oh, okay. So Dominic Cummings, basically, he had no actual political power within British government. He wasn't an elected official. He was sort of Boris Johnson's like spin guy, like would advise him on things. And for some reason, when he got caught breaching our COVID regulations, so our COVID guidance, which was obviously don't travel around the country because there's a virus that's killing people, you idiots. He decided he would travel, I think like 250 miles from London to a city called Durham, which is where he's originally from. He was spotted by quite a few people just sort of out walking with his wife and his child, came up with all these excuses about it. And obviously during our lockdowns, I don't know if it was the same in the States, but there were actual prosecutions that were supposed to happen for breaching COVID. So you're meant to get fined, or you're meant to get like, you know, I don't think an official police record or anything, but you were meant to get a fine, you were meant to get a telling off and stern words. And he had this whole press conference in Downing Street, which is sort of our equivalent to the White House, if you don't know. I remember the media just thinking like, well, just saying things like, this is really uncommon. We don't have advisors doing this. This is for prime ministers. Why have we got this guy who's been like this puppet master behind the scenes giving this speech? Like, we don't care, mate. Just resign, pay your fine, say you were in the wrong. And his attitude, it was just so belligerent. He's just not a pleasant man.
Horrible people who do horrible things, and then like even those within the government are embarrassed by them. And that's kind of happened in the Trump cabinet here. Like, anyone who was moderate can't get in anymore. You have to be sycophantic. You have to be, I'm thinking of Mike Lindell and Rudy Giuliani and Pam Bondi, and there's just this list of culprits at this point where we're all so embarrassed and horrified. I don't know if you had any thoughts on the Julius Streicher opening that I talked about, the propaganda messaging.
So I didn't actually know about this person at all, but I find it very, very interesting that he's one of the people that was executed. It seems very much sort of like that felt like sending a message. That feels very much like sending a message, like the from Nuremberg, sort of like, you know, if you're going to perpetuate this hate, if you're going to spout it to the level that you have that has instigated X, Y, and Z, or, you know, fan the flames kind of thing, there's going to be a consequence. It's almost like chat shit, see what happens.
Yeah. And then we think of the, I don't know, in America, for example, well, and in Britain too, the anti-immigrant kind of fervor that has stoked, that's resulted in the ICE stuff going on currently, which feels like the SS, which is the S-men. And then we got like the anti-trans and anti-queer rhetoric. And it's a rough time. So that leads me to my final question for you, my friend. How you doing in 2026?
Personally, I'm fine. I'm as somebody who, you know, I'm not an immigrant. I'm a white cisgendered male. I tend to not be as impacted by this sort of thing. This is very much me sort of understanding that I'm speaking from a place of privilege as well. But obviously I see what's happening. I don't like it. It's just vile. I just really wish that people would look around, open their eyes, wake up and realize that we are being pointed in the direction of easy targets, so that we don't blame the people actually ruining things, which are our governments, by the way, if everybody, it's our governments ruining it.
We're one queer man to another, an ocean between us. We're doing our best, friends.
We're trying, okay? We're really trying.
Daniel, you're a newer friend of mine. I'm thrilled to have your acquaintance. I can't wait to hang out again and again on the show. You're really fun to vibe with. Thanks for joining me for this conversation.
Not a problem. Anytime. Thank you for having me. It's been a delight as always. And by always, I mean both times now.
We've already got more plans, which I'm excited about. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening. Please take care of yourselves. Living joyfully is an act of defiance in this crazy day and age. And we'll see you back here next week on the Grey Malkin Lane Show. Thank you for listening to Grey Malkin Lane. We hope you are enjoying this podcast. Grey Malkin Lane is produced and recorded in Salt Lake City, Utah, with music and editing done by my husband, Michael Bell, and promo art done by the incredible Seth Martell. Look for us on Patreon, where we are releasing weekly episodes about obscure characters and facts. It's a great way to participate with the podcast for only just a couple of dollars a month, and it helps support what we are doing here. Also, the best way you could help Grey Malkin Lane is by sharing and liking and subscribing, but also please leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. We'll see you back here next time on Grey Malkin Lane.